My name is Shredda, and this is The Lightner Side of Things, Practitioner Perspectives in School Psychology, a place for school psychology practitioners to come together and share experiences and insights about their work. Today, I'm talking with Dr. Dwight Hood, and about a few different things about working within an urban school district setting and working your work with the State Association of School Psychologists. But I want to first have you talk about yourself. Tell us about your training and the type of setting that you're currently practicing in.
Okay, so I'm currently practicing in an urban setting. I practice in a variety of different settings. So just to say a little bit about myself, I kind of stumbled into school psych, and let me explain what I mean by that. So as a high school student, I enjoyed writing. And so it's kind of ironic that I'm now in a field that requires writing of so many reports and analyses and assessments and what have you. But at any rate, I enjoyed writing. So my high school counselor said, well, Dwight, you should probably get into communications. And so I was thinking, communications, I'm not so sure about that. I wasn't even sure if I wanted to sit and write novels or write news. I didn't really know. So I got accepted into the Syracuse University Newhouse School of Communications. And I kind of fumbled around there because I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Someone came in and did a presentation for us on magazine writing. And it seemed that he was working freelance. And so even in a young age, I always figured, you know, I wanted to get married, have kids, have a family, you know, have the white picket fence sort of thing. And I didn't think doing freelance work would allow me to do that. So that kind of stalled in my brain. And so, you know, I found myself as a sophomore, college sophomore, going on college junior, and I hadn't really decided on a major. But what I had from high school was these credits for a Syracuse Project Advance. And that was in psychology. And I remember in high school, I took a psychology course with Mr. Bernard McQuillan. And so I enjoyed the course. I looked forward to it. It was really interesting. He had a fun way of teaching. But I just kind of put that in the back burner. I didn't think that I'd be interested in psychology as a major or let alone become a psychologist. So I realized that here I am, I'm going to be a junior and I don't have a major, but I'd really like to graduate on time. So I figured I had these extra psychology courses. If I were a psychology major, that would be practical because I would have enough credits to graduate on time. So that began my journey. And of course, you know, I sat through these lecture halls and, you know, the courses in and of themselves weren't very interesting, but I enjoyed the content. So to be perfectly frank, I'd skip the lecture and I'd sit at home and I'd really enjoyed reading the content and I'd get good grade. And so now I'm about to graduate high school. I mean, not high school, but college rather. And I don't really know what I want to do with my life. You know, I'm a psychology major. I never fancied myself to become a psychologist, but I did this as something practical. So I'd be able to graduate and wouldn't cost my parents any money. So I went to another advisor. And of course, the advisor asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, well, I'd like to do something with kids. I don't really see myself as a teacher, but I'd like to do something with kids because I would like to help kids through the experience of school. And he said, well, why don't you try school psychology? And I said to myself, I don't really want to be a teacher or a counselor. Okay, school psychology. So I did a practicum for Syracuse City Schools and I met some really great people. And I said, okay, I think I can do this. So I did my my first practicum in Syracuse City Schools, a small urban school district. And I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the staff and I really enjoyed the families and I really enjoyed the students. And I said, okay, so that was my jumping off point for my career. So I decided to enroll. Well, I got accepted to Temple University's doctoral program in school psych. And so I came out of Syracuse with a certification. And so I got a job with Philadelphia Public Schools. So I worked, and then while working, I pursued the doctorate at Temple. So that's kind of how I got into school psych.
That's a really long, interesting journey. I love hearing that because I feel like everyone has such a different entry point into school psychology. I think that's great.
Yeah, I don't look at it as an entry point. I think of it more as a stumbling point.
Stumbling point. I like that.
Yeah, I kind of rolled through an open door and I was like, oh, I think I'll stay. So, yeah. In terms of the work that I'm doing now for the ASP, the Association of School Psychologists of Pennsylvania, honestly, I kind of stumbled into that too. So the prior chair for the diversity committee, I think, you know, she wanted to move on to other things and she just put it out there to the committee. And, you know, I was kind of part of the committee. So my committee participation was, you know, I'm kind of on social media and I'm reading things and I'm liking things and I'm saying, oh, that's interesting. Oh, that's good. So mm-hmm. She put it out there that, okay, I'm moving on to other things and I can't really do this anymore. Is anyone interested? So kind of on the spur, I said, well, I'd be interested. I had no idea what I would do or how I would tackle this or what I was supposed to do. So she gave me like a brief orientation and kind of went on her way. And here I was. So I have to be honest, for about a year and a half, I didn't really do much because I didn't really know what to do. So then after about a year, I started going to the meetings. And basically I said to the executive board, thanks for having me, but I don't really know what I'm to do or supposed to do or really want to do. And they said, well, Dwight, don't worry. It's a volunteer position. We're happy to have you. You typically, we're committees of one in that the chair kind of does what they do and you kind of listen to everyone's ideas and we kind of deal with the pressing issues of the moment. And just because you have a title as a particular chair for a committee doesn't mean that you can't participate in other committees and do other things. So that was very comforting. That was very comforting because, you know, part of what I was feeling, and we often discuss this as people of color, as the imposter syndrome, because here I have this title in a state organization and I'm not doing anything and I don't really know what I need to do. So that was very comforting. So I started attending more of the meetings at the state level. And recently I feel like I was able to make my best contribution because I was able to, you know, lead the committee and make our social justice statement. So that was kind of like my first big thing. And the second thing I guess I'm involved in now, and it's not under the auspices of diversity. It's as well, I'm a member of the, you know, the state association, is that we're trying to kind of act as kind of like the de facto advisory board for school districts in the state on PPE and COVID-related issues and how are we going to reopen and how are we going to keep ourselves safe and how are we going to keep the students safe and how are we going to consult continually with school districts. So while we don't have a specific statement, these are kind of ongoing things that we're working on. So I have to say I'm very enthused and I'm very proud to be part of these efforts.
And that's fantastic that the association has those relationships with districts, with educators in the state to be able to provide that advice and provide that guidance from that school psychologist perspective.
Yeah, we're certainly trying. I mean, this stuff's unprecedented. So it's like everyone kind of feels like, you know, you're flying on the seat of your pants, to coin an old expression. But that's just kind of how it is. These are unprecedented times. So
we absolutely for sure.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about the social justice statement? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. In fact, I have it in front of me. So basically, what we wanted to do to kind of summarize everything is that we made the statement, but the idea is that this is a continuing dialogue, and it's kind of like an ongoing mission. So we what we wanted to do, and what I suggested and everyone agreed, is that, you know, we should kind of mirror Ness's statement for social justice, and we should really try to, as an ongoing mission, carry on a lot of those initiatives at the state level. So some of the things that we propose to do are attend and provide ongoing training around anti-racist educational policies. We want to examine school curricula carefully in a continuing effort to determine whether the curricula meets standards for social equity. We'd like to work to reduce disproportionality by race and ethnicity in school discipline by carefully examining school behavioral data and reducing ambiguity in the definition and management of problem behavior in schools. We'd like to further attend and provide ongoing training on implicit and explicit bias and examine how these biases impact staff and student interactions. We'd like to foster continued collaboration between school and community-based mental health professionals, school resource officers, and law enforcement to implement evidence-based practices in the routine discipline of students, including students with disabilities, consistent with trainings provided by the National Association of School Resource Officers. So we'd like to continue to do a lot of things. And then one of the things we'd like to do, and you know, I'm personally invested and I like to be more involved in this, is to recruit Black students to school psychology graduate programs to build a more diverse school psychology workforce that is more representative of student populations.
That's amazing. I think that's very impressive that the board was able to come together and collaborate on that statement. And I know other states are in the process of, or you know, working on statements that are similar to that. I like how intertwined it is with NAST's statement.
Yes.
And I like that it has many different components, because as school psychologists, we're trained in so many different things and such a holistic approach to development and psychology. So I like that that statement addresses those many different components. You touched on wanting to recruit more Black students in school psychology.
Yeah.
And I'm glad you brought that up, because I did want to talk about that as well. So per the NAST 2015 member survey, we do not have a lot of individuals of color in the field. Per that survey, which had 1,274 respondents, 87% reported their race as white, which would make 13% as non-white. It seems like there is a little bit of an increase. I know when that survey, this is from 2015, when that survey was taken in 1990, there were fewer people responding as identifying as non-white. So I think there's been about a 7% increase in non-white school psychologists since 1990.
Right.
Which is positive, but we know it's still not enough. So I wanted to ask you, first of all, why do we need more individuals of color, especially more Black students coming into school psychology? And why is it hard? Why don't we have that type of representation right now?
Okay, so I think to address those two points, why we need more, I can simply say that, you know, a lot of the students that I work with are students of color. And so it honestly doesn't matter if I worked in an urban setting, even when I worked in a rural setting, and now I work in an urban setting. You know, disproportionately, students of color are identified for special education programs. So it just stands to reason that in order to serve the population, we need people that understand directly the needs of the population. Mm-hmm. So secondly, in terms of why there aren't a whole lot of people of color, specifically African-Americans in school, Now, I can address this from a, I think I can shed some light on this from a personal level, and I can go back to my experiences in graduate school. So one of the things I remember is that, okay, so school districts court prospective employees a little bit differently than, say, a business would. And let me explain what I mean by that. So I remember when, you know, people that I went to school with that were, you know, going toward business degrees, I remember, you know, the company would fly them out or the company would give them incentives. And, you know, me looking at school districts, it was kind of like, I remember I had a conversation with one of my classmates and he was like, well, you want to do this internship. Well, did they fly you out? And I was like, no, school districts don't typically do that. And he was like, well, they're not going to pay you. I said, no, it's hard to get a paid internship in school psychology. And so the courtship is different because, you know, schools often have limited resources. And even the schools or school districts that are more affluent, I mean, certainly there aren't a lot of monies or resources allocated for students per se. So the courtship is different. So it may not be as attractive. So certainly when I was telling my classmates about the interviews I had with school districts, you know, and their companies are flying them out and, you know, CEOs are coming to court them with dinners and paying for their hotels and things like that. You know, I didn't receive any of that. So I think that's kind of one factor. Another factor is that, you know, when you think about, you know, working in a school system or a school district, particularly in an urban setting, you know, it's very, very low resources and very high demand. So you think about the horror stories that, you know, that people hear, or the stigmatizing stereotypes. I remember in the early 2000s, I think, or in the late 90s, there was this show on TV. It was called Boston Public. I don't know if you remember that.
About, the
school district in Boston. And so, or if you remember that movie that Michelle Pfeiffer was in, Dangerous Minds.
Right.
Even if you think of the administrator, Joe Clark, the African-American administrator, and his biography. So these are how urban schools are portrayed. So needless to say, it's a very rough, scary, non-paying environment. So when you kind of consider those things, it's kind of like, okay, you have to be really, really altruistic and you have to really be called to do that kind of work, but it's certainly not presented as the most appealing sort of work. So if you think of urban schools and the issues that urban schools have, there's high rates of burnout. And so, you know, if you think of working in an urban school or in an urban mental health setting or in any type of urban environment, it's the whole concept of high need, limited resources. And it's very, very tough. So it's not only recruiting people of color, but it's maintaining people of color. And it's very, very difficult to do. It's very difficult to do. So I'm not presenting this as an excuse. I'm just saying that this is a reality. And again, it's like, you know, I really enjoy what I do. You know, I enjoy the practical facets of the job in terms of the salary and the benefits, but it's very, very difficult. You know, I remember times when, you know, I had a legal case to do and I didn't have an updated IQ test. I didn't have rating scales. I had to go to another school and borrow materials from somebody else. And I had the administrator complaining, well, why is he always leaving the building? It's like, okay, those things aren't conducive to retaining quality professionals.
Right. Oh, those are really good points. And I think a lot of school psychs out there will be able to relate to all of that. I've thought about this question many times myself. Why mm-hmm. don't we have more individuals of color in our field? And I I often thought about graduate school and kind of what you talk about in terms of the courtship process. I kind of see that relating to graduate school as well, and the amount of fees that it takes to get into and remain in a school psychology program, the fact that you do need a car most times to get to your practicums.
Yes, and that was the problem that I had in Syracuse because, you know, growing up in New York City, I didn't drive until I was 25. So basically, in order to get back and forth to practicum and a lot of these things, I had to solicit my friends and ask them to drive me because, you know, I didn't have a car and I wasn't driving. So yeah, if for practical things as well too. And then in terms of graduate training, school psychology programs tend to be longer than other programs.
Right.
There are a lot of graduate programs that are a year and a half, but I remember my master's level program at State University, it was a 2.5, 3-year program. So again, you know, I remember having to, I was able to get a fellowship, thank God, to be able to offset some of the costs. But it's hard. And I know for my doctorate, that was a long haul. That was a long 10-year haul because I was working and going to school. And so when you're working and going to school, it's like work is first. And so when you're working, a lot of the courses that I needed to continue along with my cohort, you know, if a course is offered during the day, I can't stay home from work during the day. I have to work. So that means I have to wait until the next year until the course is offered. And hopefully it's offered in the evening. If it were offered during the day, I couldn't take it. I remember I was fortunate because I remember this. I actually forgot about this. I think like 15 years ago, I was able to petition when the school district of Philadelphia was in clusters. So these are like small school districts. And I was able to petition my administrator and I came up with this plan where I think, what was it? I think I left every day. I left work every day at 12 on Thursday so I can get to the residency. There was a residency course I had to take and it was offered during the day from 1 to 4. So I petitioned her and I said, okay, if I leave, it's a 40-hour work week, but I have to leave, I think, every Thursday at 1. So I have to make up X amount of hours. So if I stay late these days and come early on these days and I fulfill these duties, I can make up the time and still fulfill my duties. And I remember I was like, I proposed this to her and I had to wait like a couple months. And thank God she approved it, because if she didn't approve it, I wouldn't be able to do that residency and I wouldn't be able to finish.
Wow.
Yeah.
Certainly some extra hoops to jump through.
Yeah.
And I think you also touched on this as well, that sometimes the space that we go into as school psychologists, you know, it's one thing to get in, but it's another thing to feel supported and welcome and safe in that space. And I think that applies to, it can be districts, it can be graduate programs, where we know the majority of our field right now is represented by practitioners who identify as white and scholars and researchers who identify as white. So like you said, that space, once you get into it, it really makes a difference how supported you feel in that space.
Yeah. And another issue I find with the space, and I'm glad you raised that, is that in this profession, I find it's a lot about managing expectations. And when I say expectations, it's kind of like when I come through the door as a Black male, it's kind of like, okay, I see that people have certain expectations in me. So sometimes their expectations aren't honestly consistent with my expectations. So a lot of times I feel like even with other jobs I've done as like a group facilitator or an outpatient therapist, it's kind of like people will say this. They'll look at me and say, okay, well, we need somebody with a presence. So it's kind of like, we need somebody that kind of looks like them, that's assertive to manage the group. We don't really need somebody to do therapy or unlock their feelings or teach any skills. We just need a manager. Whereas, you know, other people are looked at as, oh, okay, well, this is a clinician, or this person has skills, or this person can do a lot of assessments. But you know, we need you because you have a presence about you, because we need you to be a manager. And, you know, I've read a lot of blogs from Black male educators, and that's a consistent theme or a consistent expectation that I'm there as a manager. I'm not really there as a clinician, or I'm not really there to impart information. It's like I'm there as a manager and a referee so that the real work can occur. So it's almost like you're minimized.
Right.
Another expectation I often have to manage too is that, you know, I know this might sound ridiculous practitioner to practitioner, but a lot of the people that we deal with as psychologists, particularly as school psychologists, may not understand what we do. So it's kind of like there's this thinking, and I've often talked to non-professional staff or various staff throughout the building that think that, you know, it's almost kind of like what I do is kind of like this Freudian psychoanalytic thing when the kids come into the office.
Right. So
there isn't this understanding that, you know, I'm part of a team that's doing primarily assessments to determine if kids need special services. It's like, you know, I'm gonna manage those kids that have some sort of mental deficit. You know, I'm going to analyze them, and then I'm going to impart the wisdom to everybody that deals with them. This is how you manage them, you know, that kind of thing. So it's often that expectation. And then there's another expectation with, okay, well, we have all these children that we've identified as having some pathology. There's something wrong with them. So we need you to sign off and write those papers so that we can exclude them someplace. So we can put them in a different class or a different placement. You know, it's kind of like, you know, we refer them, you're going to test them, and then we're going to place them somewhere. Whereas, you know, and in working in a large district with limited resources, you know, it's imparting that expectation on the team that, okay, the students aren't going anywhere, they're our students, and we have to work together to figure out how we're going to program for these students' needs. So it's not just me sitting with them and writing a prescription so for when they go someplace. It's like, no, we've got to work collaboratively because these are our kids and we've got to help and service our kids.
So right.
I always find that I'm managing a bunch of expectations.
What you described is a very kind of one note old school perception of school psychology, which unfortunately we're still
it's very relevant. Yep, absolutely. It's still there. Yep.
Do you feel that you've become more comfortable in addressing those, or do you even think there are microaggressions? What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, we can use whatever semantic terms we can to address them, and I'm fine with that. I think that's part of my role, though, is to constantly address them. Because, you know, even if people say that I have a presence, I think my presence and my work addresses those. You see what I mean? So that if I'm in a particular situation where people think that, oh, thank God he's here, they'll keep those kids under control. And it's like, well, I'm talking to them and it's obvious that I'm exposing them and it's kind of riling them up in a way, but that's the work that has to be done in order to teach them the self-management skills. That's the work that needs to be done. And so sometimes in the past, people have actually been upset with me because their expectation is that, well, I control their behavior, but I say, well, no, I'm not the disciplinarian. I'm the school psychologist. So if we're having a group and, you know, the group is on social skills, I'd like to work on the very skill that they're having problems with. So if the skill they need to work on is managing their emotions, then we have to deal with the emotions. So it's not helpful for them or it's not helpful for us to constantly be quelling the emotions. Yes, we have to quell the emotion in the hallway, or we have to quell the emotion in dismissal, but I need you all to work with me because this is group. So this is where we need to dig up the emotions and then model strategies as to how to work on those emotions, if that makes sense.
Yes, that does. Yeah. So all of that said, in your opinion, what are the steps or what actions do you think could be taken by whether it's state organizations or graduate programs to attract more diverse individuals to the field, especially more Black individuals? So I know that's a tall task.
It is a tall task, but I think it's something that needs to be dealt with, and it needs to be dealt with in a practical way. So I went back to the courtships. Okay. So, you know, the school districts that I've worked for, we may not have high financial resources, but, you know, it would be nice if I were in an administrative position, and maybe I need to seek this out for myself, where, you know, I could go to a campus as a representative from my school district and say, you know what, here's an issue, here's a need, we need to recruit. Here's a program that's close by. We will work with the program so that you can work and go to school and still be able to do that residency requirement. Or we can offer the courses that you need in the evening so that it would be, you know, we can facilitate you being able to work and being able to go to school. I think these are practical issues that we need to deal with, because just as, you know, the CEOs came to meet my colleagues at the airport, it would be nice if I knew that, okay, a school district really wanted me, and it's nice to read these things, but if you really want me, well, come out and meet me halfway. You see what I mean?
Right.
There are tangible things that can be done rather than, you know, well, we put it on a paper and we organized a committee, but let's do some tangible things to attract, you know, members of ethnic minorities. And it doesn't necessarily have to be people of color per se. We want the best people. And if those happen to be people of color, so be it. But we really need the best people. We really need the smartest and most committed people.
Absolutely. I like it. I like the idea of school districts partnering with graduate programs to kind of solve some of those problems together and make that room.
Yeah, because we really need to recruit people, because I look at my own experiences and, you know, it's the connections that I made with people that drew me into the field. Because honestly, you know, I look back on the field supervisors I had at a master's level, and, you know, they really took me under their wing on a personal level. So they were the people that would drive me back and forth to these practicum, and they would call me at night and say, well, Dwight, how's the studying going? Do you need anything? We can drop you off some food. You know, Dwight, if you need to come home with me, that's fine. And, you know, you can wait here for 20 minutes and I'll take you to the bus station. Those are the things that help keep me going. And I think those are the things that, you know, we need to do if we want to attract students to this field.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the setting in which you're practicing in, which is a large public school district in a major city. In that same survey that I talked about before, the NASP survey found that 25% of school psychologists work in an urban setting, 50% work in a suburban setting, and 21% work in a rural setting. And we know research has shown that urban communities do tend to have different needs than suburban and rural communities. Mm-hmm. In your opinion, what are the major needs of the students and families that you serve, and how has it shaped your role as their school psychologist?
So I think one of the major things that we need and we continue to need is community outreach. And I think a lot of times in order to best serve the needs of the school community, you kind of have to link up with the home community. So there are examples where it's like we've had to hold meetings after hours, maybe before hours, to accommodate people that are working, to accommodate certain situations that really aren't ideal. We've really had to be flexible, and I found that I've had to be flexible. I've done testing in people's homes. I've stayed after school to meet with families. I've come to meet with families before school. I actually worked in a school a couple years ago where the students were in different annexes. So I literally had to drive to different sections of one part of the city to actually accommodate all my kids. So these aren't things that I encountered in a suburban setting. That would be one thing. And the second thing I think is monetary resources. And that's directly impacted me in terms of supplies that I've needed as a school psychologist, in terms of office space, in terms of testing equipment. I'm often jealous because I watch shows on Netflix where the school counselor and the school psychologist, they have this nice office that has, the placard with their name on it. And, right. I currently work in a converted bathroom. And so, I have a little piece of paper that identifies who I am, Dr. Hood, and I share it during the week with three different people. And at any different time, I might work with students, behind the stage, or I might work with them in the library, or I might work with them in a colleague's classroom. And so this goes back to like the appeal and the courtship. It really is a calling to work in an urban setting. And so I often joke with some of my colleagues when I'm in the auditorium behind the stage. I'm like, wait a minute, you like my new office? So I think these are the challenges of working in an urban setting. I often joke that the window in the office I use now, I mean, the window opens, but there isn't a screen. So one time I was testing last year and a pigeon hopped on the ledge and I swore it was coming in. And so the student jumped and I jumped, and I remember, I hate to admit this, but I threw my pen at the pigeon because I didn't want the pigeon to come in, because that would have been a disaster. And so I figure if I knock the pigeon or I throw something at the pigeon and scare the pigeon off, it would fly away. And sure enough, it did. So that leads me to, the COVID-19 related issues and whether or not we're going to open for September, because, there's this promise in the district plan of PPE and social distancing, and we don't know how that's going to happen. And, a lot of us work, like me, work in these older schools where asbestos is still a problem and ventilation is an issue. And like I said, sure, I can have ventilation in the office where I work, but it's like there's no screen, and, I'd have to prop a piece of cardboard there or something so that the critters don't come in. So, these are the challenges that we face. You know what I mean? These are the challenges that we face. And even, I've been trying to test using the iPads, but unfortunately, and a colleague of mine has been helping me, and she tells me, Dwight, you don't really need the internet connection to work, but I'm just not comfortable enough. So it's like I'm trying to configure the iPads, and because of the concrete surrounding, the office where I'm in, that's a converted bathroom, and the wireless router, the huge wireless system, is in the bathroom above me, but because of the concrete, it's not consistent. So I have trouble configuring the iPads. So my worst nightmare is that I'm trying to configure the iPads during the assessment, and then it's like, okay, well, something goes out during the assessment and the students are looking at me like, Dr. Hood, like, what is this? Can I go back to class? You know what I mean? So yeah. I'm still doing the traditional assessment, but I really like to move into the digital assessment, but I just don't feel comfortable doing that. So there are a lot of practical things that I have to deal with, and I've learned to deal with it. And I just kind of roll with it, because at this point, if I were to move to a suburban district, those are other issues that I'd have to deal with. So, you know, it is what it is. It kind of is what it is. So,
yeah, it's really astonishing. Like, people truly understood the conditions under which the mental health providers for their children work.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder what kind of change that would bring.
Well, I tell my family members about these things and they think I'm making it up. They think I'm making it up because their thing is like, well, you're a big time doctor in Philadelphia. So, you know, that doesn't happen. Aren't you a doctor? That doesn't happen. Doctors don't go through these things. So no, they don't believe me. They don't believe me. They think I'm just making it up.
So you mentioned COVID, and I feel like we're in a little bit of a cultural shift here that's long overdue, that's occurring, you know, with COVID and the inequities that it is really highlighting and bringing out, making very visible for people, as well as the Black Lives Matter movement and the inequities that that's making more visible.
Yes.
And really bringing to light for a lot of people. Given those two major things happening in our society, how do you see the needs of your students evolving in the future?
Well, I can address that in a couple ways. So first, I can address the instruction piece. So I am a member of the Delaware Valley Association of Black Psychologists. And recently we had kind of like a community town hall kind of virtual thing where we discussed that. And part of my input was discussing how, you know, COVID-19 has brought along this virtual instruction. And so cyber charter schools have been doing this for years. And, you know, you can question how effective it is, or, you know, is it, you know, what are the outcomes and is it really beneficial, particularly for students with special needs? But, you know, it's not something for us to argue and debate now, because, you know, it's necessitated. Current circumstances have necessitated that we move rapidly and drastically to virtual instruction. So one of the issues that's come up for me as a parent, never mind as a professional, but as a parent, is all these Zoom meetings and, you know, all this virtual instruction and having, you know, I have two boys that are kind of like on opposite ends of the needs continuum. So I have my older son who has profound special needs, and I have my younger son who's taking, you know, AP courses. And so with both of them, I have concerns. I'm concerned for my older son is that, you know, is he getting virtually kind of like the speech and occupational therapy and physical therapy that he needs at home over the computer? And I'm concerned for my younger son is that, okay, with a lot of this virtual instruction, he's teaching himself, you know, advanced math and physics. So I, as a parent, I'm concerned for both of them, and I'm concerned about the quality of their instruction. And so as a parent, you know, I feel for the parents that I work with, because, you know, you have children that are trying to advance themselves. Whereas, you know, for my younger son, cyber school was an option, but our home district just told us that a lot of the honors and advanced placement courses aren't offered in a cyber format. So he's going to have to go to school physically if he'd like to continue with that. And I'm also concerned for my older son, because, you know, he goes to a predominantly special needs school, and, you know, they're planning to open up in September. And so, you know, he has cerebral palsy. And so the kids with those type of disabilities, it's not advisable that they wear masks. So the adults have to wear the masks and the PPEs. So I'm concerned about, you know, is he going to get exposed during the school day? I'm concerned that, okay, if we continue with this virtual option, it's kind of like, okay, what are the therapies going to look like? So I think I can relate to the anxieties and the fears of the parents, because I have those anxieties and fears too as a parent myself. So
sure.
I think that, you know, large urban school districts, you know, with issues with resources in terms of the school districts and the families. So one of the things that I discussed is that, okay, well, we're handing out a bunch of Chromebooks, but not everybody's used to dealing with a Chromebook. And some people are using their phones or their iPads. Well, think of it. If you have, you know, 2 and 3 and 4 students in front of a phone and they're supposed to receive instruction, well, what's the quality of that instruction going to look like? And then, of course, you know, not all of us have the luxury of being able to sit home and work virtually and remotely. So if the kids are home and I have to work, well, who's going to supervise my kids? And particularly, who's going to supervise the kids during instruction? So, you know, these are a lot of things that I'm thinking about as not only a practitioner, but I'm thinking about as a parent as well.
Definitely a very complicated issue. And I feel like there's no perfect answer.
No, there is no answer, because this is all new to all of us.
Right. Well, I really appreciated your thoughts and your insights. And
well, sure, I appreciate,
really
you
appreciate
having
your time.
It's been a nice experience. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to The Leitner Side of Things. If you have any feedback or topic ideas, let me know on Twitter. My Twitter handle is @SGERA99. See you at the next episode.